Hello and welcome to the Answers for Cancers podcast. I'm your host, Anne-Marie Fay.
And I'm Michelle Matthews.
Together with some of Ireland's leading experts, we want to unravel what it truly means to have cancer.
From consultant diagnosis to treatment plans, from managing your symptoms to supports available, we have it covered. So whether you're a nurse working in oncology or have been personally affected by cancer, this podcast is for you. We would like to say a special thank you to Pfizer Healthcare Ireland for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. Dr. Sinead Lynch is a senior counselling psychologist with the psych oncology team in the Mater Hospital in Dublin. With a doctorate in counselling psychology from Trinity College Dublin, Sinead explains to us how events in her personal life led her into her passion for psychology for cancer patients. The psych oncology service was set up in the Mater Hospital in 2021, and from my personal experience on the ground, I've seen the incredible positive impact this service has had for our patients. Sinead is also running a study called the Comfort Trial, which is for people who have had a progression or recurrence of cancer during the COVID-19 pandemic, and this may be of interest to some of our listeners. In this episode, we discuss the difference between pity and self-compassion and how self-kindness does not mean giving in. Sinead helps us to understand the difference between what is a normal feeling after a cancer diagnosis and when we should seek help. She also talks us through practical tips of managing our mental health and the importance of breathing. And she closes with a beautiful mindfulness practice. We hope you enjoy this episode as much as we did. Good afternoon, Sinead. Thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast. I might just kick it off by asking you, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself and your interest in the area of psych-oncology?
Okay, well, thanks for having me. I'm Sinead. I'm the psychologist in the psych-oncology department. I'll talk a little bit maybe later about the whole team. There's more than just me. But I initially studied psychology about 25 years ago in UCD, and I kind of thought at the time, this is great, but I'll go back to it later in life. I had this, you know, stereotypical view that, I don't know, maybe I had a counselor in mind or something, but I expected it to be a much older person and maybe someone with life experience. And I was, you know, 18 and kind of thought, oh, hang on, I want to do something creative. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I suppose, you know, long story short, I ended up working in television, and I spent about 10 years working in television. And when I was 26, my own mum was diagnosed with cancer, and that obviously just rocked my world and it changed everything. I think I enjoyed TV from a perspective of this is a bit of fun, but I was always wondering what was going to be next. Always felt like I was kind of questioning, you know, is this a career? A difficult career as well, like sort of unsteady. And so when my mum got cancer, it sort of put a lot of things in perspective, and I sort of felt like I grew up a lot. And I really understand the experience of what it's like when someone you love has cancer. Yeah. Mm. So, you know, she had a difficult 4 years and then she died from cancer. And at that point, you know, as I said, it rocked my world, but it changed my whole perspective on life. Mm. And I felt like I really wanted to go back to something that I loved and felt passionate about. And that was, I suppose, psychology. But then I was really focused on how do I work? Like, how do I zone in and make this, I suppose, not just a profession, but how do I make this like the passionate work that I had felt at that point? Later in life, you know, really, really good friend died from cancer. And I remember when I was in the room with him, when he was told how bad it was, he described it as just like a white noise and he couldn't hear anything. And when we went outside, you know, he just broke down, and a nurse followed and sort of said, you know, we're sorry. And, you know, is there anyone you can talk to? And I suppose it just highlighted to me that need for people to be able to talk about the experience of having cancer. Many years more of study. Then I went back and I studied psychotherapy. I went and studied counseling psychology in Trinity. And I suppose my first step into psycho-oncology was in St. Vincent's University Hospital. It was on a placement. And I got to combine kind of my TV career with psychology and with RTE and with Paul Dalton and Vincent's. We created a documentary with cancer patients from the Marie Keating Foundation, and we walked the Camino and we practiced mindfulness, and it was amazing to bring the two together and to produce that. And that was in 2016. So, and then a few years later, I was constantly going, okay, I'm graduated now. You know, fully fledged. Where can I get my job? And was constantly looking. And then the job came up in the Mater, and I was like, wow, dream job. Yeah. You know, everyone I've lost before me, including my poor dog, Edgar, who also got cancer at one point in my life, I felt, seriously? Yeah. You know, I was like, you know, help me through this and get me where I need to be. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've been here in the matter for 2 years now. And
brilliant. I actually think we started around the same time. I kind of remember I started about 2 years ago as well, and there was like an influx of new people around the same time. And I remember thinking, they're new.
You know, people are new.
But we're so sorry to hear about your mum and your friend Sinead. And thanks so much for sharing that with us. I think it's so reflective sometimes when you're caring for people and you have personally gone through something yourself. Mm-hmm. Your style just changes altogether, doesn't it? Because you can really sympathize and understand with how they're feeling.
Yeah. And you know, sometimes people say, even in maybe in training in psychology, you know, how do you listen, or is it because you've been there? Mm. And of course that's not true. Like, as psychologists, we can't have experienced everything that people experience. And that's where the training comes in. But for me, I guess, yes, I have experienced that sense of being with someone from, you know, the beginning to the end and more than once. Yeah. And so I think sometimes when you can really not just have that empathy, but that further step of kind of compassion, you know, it takes you to a different place past training. And as you said, your own life experience changes with that different perspective. And what's meaningful for you in life kind of becomes the most important thing then.
And it takes your passion to like a whole nother level, doesn't it?
Yes.
And I suppose it's really evident in the work that you're doing with the team, like you said, with Psycho-Oncology and the Matter. And we know that you're celebrating this second year anniversary with Psycho-Oncology, which is massive congratulations. It opened in March, like we just said. I suppose, what was that like, starting that whole service within the hospital?
Yeah, so when I started, it was just Edel there. So Edel is our Psycho-Oncology CNS. And I think I started about a week after Edel, and the two of us were in this small office up at the top of the building on Michael Street. Yeah. And we were like, right, you know, it was really daunting. Yeah, and of course, you know, we had different backgrounds, but it was really about, I suppose, not only following the NCCP model, because it was through the NCCP that kind of funded these posts. It was like, right, what's our vision here?
What does it look like on the ground as well? It can be very different, can't it?
Yeah. Well, especially because on one hand, it was so lovely, but everyone was so enthusiastic about us joining. But on the other hand, it was overwhelming, because there was like, okay, we have so many referrals. We'd love you to see so many people.
Yeah.
And, you know, being able to provide a service where we're trying to holistically not just look at the diagnosis of cancer and what it's like on the body, but also what it's like for the person emotionally, mentally, you know, what is their mental health? Yeah. Not just in the realm of, do they have a history of any sort of, you know, mental illness or any mental health issues, but rather that, you know, as we've just said, like, you know, getting a cancer diagnosis can really change your life.
Absolutely. It's nearly like a trauma when it happens to somebody, like,
Yeah. And we all have different coping skills and maybe we've never realized before what our coping skills are. And not only that, but like, illness will change how we cope. So maybe we've coped before by being busy and now all of a sudden we're at a standstill, you know, so how do we deal with this?
So
initially it was just, you know, myself and Edel, and obviously supported by, you know, our managers and our separate teams within the Matter. And then we had our, you know, Anne, who is our consultant psychiatrist. And then we had our social worker, Sinead. And it's growing now again. We've just got another psychologist, Susan. And we have another psychiatrist, Lola. And we're going to get another medical social worker as well. So you can see, it's really growing. But myself and Edel recently were just like, oh, 2 years, jeepers, does it feel longer? Like,
And I suppose starting that resource, it was back in March 2020, just as the COVID-19 pandemic was hitting as well. So you kind of had a double whammy at the same time.
Yes, and I had had a baby, my daughter, in COVID. And I remember she was born in June 2020. And in the March, everyone said to me, oh, you'll be grand by June, it'll be over.
Yes, famous last words.
So I'd sort of been on a maternity leave, whereas I guess for Edel, she had been working in Galway. So for me, it was a real launch into, oh my God, the world is still running. And what's it like being in a hospital? What's it like being out in the open, you know? But we did see the impact of COVID on people with cancer, because they couldn't bring, you know, partners, friends into the day ward. They couldn't, you know, maybe go into, I mean, naturally, try to accommodate them as much as possible in terms of getting results. You know, it's really a lonely place to be getting results, so you'd need family or friend with you. But yeah, you could really see the difference maybe in the day ward where I think even speaking to the nurses who had been there, you know, long before COVID, where they said there was the changes. And so that meant that a service like psycho-oncology was really needed then, because there was a loneliness factor then too, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
We definitely saw that ourselves, didn't we?
I suppose it was the premise for why we set up the podcast in the first place.
Exactly, so we can completely relate to that. And I suppose sort of touching on COVID and everything that happened around there, is that kind of what helped you come up with the COMFORT trial?
So the COMFORT trial, like as I said, when we started, various different teams in the hospital were like, brilliant, we're delighted to have you on board, you know, can you see our patients? So not just, you know, oncology, hematology, but, you know, ear, nose and throat, gynecology, you know, lots of different departments where the need was there. And I guess I met, you know, one of the consultants, Donal Brennan, and Yvonne O'Mara is, you know, a research assistant and therapist that works with him very closely in gynecology. And they said, listen, there's a grant with the Irish Cancer Society. You know, would you be interested in going for it? We can support you. And I suppose we had to think about, well, what referrals are coming into psycho-oncology? What am I seeing, I guess, on a day-to-day as a, you know, with the outpatients? At that time, Edel was primarily kind of working with inpatients and I was working a lot with outpatients. So it was that sense of people who were maybe venturing in to see me for an outpatient psychology slot and talking about not only increased anxiety because of not being able to socialize as much, or increased anxiety because they were given a diagnosis of recurrence or progression, or that they weren't doing too well, and just not being able to share that with their normal social circles. And then that loneliness factor was really coming up, not just that kind of existential loneliness of, you know, and sometimes I joke with patients and with people about journey, you know, the word journey, and especially in cancer.
I love the way you're about using that word.
But it was the sense that, like, it's a lonely existence because only you really have the disease. So while you're sharing it, it is only how you yourself kind of take it on. So, you know, there's various different theories that we work with, obviously, as psychologists, and one of them is compassion-focused theory. And in compassion-focused theory, or even in emotion-focused theory, you're looking at that existential loneliness and how do you, I suppose, support someone in caring for themselves around that loneliness. And it always comes down to self-compassion. So it was really actually through the support then, as I said, of Donal and Yvonne sort of saying, sure, go for it, see what happens. And then, you know, we got the grant and that's kind of how the study started.
And I suppose just to clarify for everybody, what's the main kind of goal or the what you're trying to achieve with the trial? And then if somebody was interested in getting involved, how would they...
So sometimes I get carried away with just being like the clinician, the psychologist who runs the group, myself and Clodagh. Clodagh is my research assistant, and we run the groups and we get really involved and we love all the people that take part in the groups. And then, you know, there's someone else on the team as well, Damien Lowry, who would have, he's a psychologist and a good kind of, you know, research background. And we have to remember that there is this research piece like that we want to show maybe at the end of this, that, you know, that if you can provide a group. Now it is online because again, there was, I suppose, those issues around not just COVID, but actually, I suppose, illness can prevent you from turning up face to face for a group sometimes. But that at the end of this, we're showing the effectiveness. So like if people were to enroll in a 6-week group, does it, you know, ease anxiety? Does it kind of promote well-being? And so that's what we're measuring, I guess, each time. And when I say, I just need to be reminded of that, don't worry, there's enough people on the team reminding me, but I just kind of get carried away with, oh, let's run another group, you know. We're halfway through, we've ran three groups already, and we'll probably, you know, we'll still run another 3 or 4 groups. So we're constantly recruiting in that area of patients who have attended the MAT or might have a consultant in the MAT, who have either disease progression or, as I said, kind of recurrence, or again, maybe are on a second or third line of treatment. Anyone really who experienced that they were getting more bad news, and especially during that time of COVID. So did it feel like it was made worse due to that loneliness, or did they feel that their anxiety had increased? So that's kind of the who we're looking for.
And if somebody was listening that was interested and they were I suppose, in the matter. Yes. Is that the main campus that you're doing?
Yes,
the trial?
It's kind of one site. And I guess at the same time, though, because the consultants in the matter, they have sometimes clinics in Navan and Cavan. And so as long as it's, you know, a consultant within the matter, okay too. Yeah. But yeah, so Clodagh is my person for, to contact. It's clodagh.finnerty @ucd.ie.
Yeah.
Or will I call out a number if you like?
Don't worry, we can actually share all of this. We will share all of these links on our Instagram, Twitter, and make sure to help you get the word out there.
Thank you.
And with the 6 weeks, is it a kind of one session a week, or how often do they attend?
So it's a session a week. We do, it's about an hour and a half. Sometimes it can kind of stretch into 2 hours. We have a short break. You know, the way yourself, you might feel like, oh, does that feel long? But actually, you know, we try to make it as practical as possible. So one of the big elements of the group is actually breath work. So I'm really passionate about breath work and breathing, which sounds a bit ridiculous because we just do it automatically all the time. But in the beginning, when I was trying to think of, okay, well, what theory will we put together for this group and what would be beneficial? Obviously, there's a lot of evidence-based and compassion-focused work, but there's so much evidence-based, and actually, if we do, you know, deep breathing, it's going to help anxiety. It's going to help the physiology of the body in terms of once the body's calm, the mind can be calm. And so I asked Gráinne, our physio, one of the physiotherapists in the matter, would she help in terms of kind of demonstrating really good breath work of, you know, again, that physiology of, we take it for granted.
Absolutely.
I mean, I went on a yoga course, I think in my 30s, and she was like, yeah, so you're not breathing properly. And I was like, really? And so to bring that awareness of, it's not just, you know, in and out, but it's, you know, deep and low.
It can be hard to get your head around because you're going through something so complex. To think that something as simple as breathing properly can help, it just doesn't seem like they kind of coincide. But it's so true when you actually breathe properly.
You know, and people often say like, oh, actually, I just realized now I'm holding my breath.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't even realize I was holding my breath. So there is so much breath work, and week on week we try to build on the skills. So, you know, even at the end of today, we can even do like a little visualization or something, but it's to try to give tangible skills to patients where they say, oh, actually, I remember doing this, and we not only did the breathing or the visualization or the meditation, but we learned about how our brains are programmed to be, you know, looking out for danger. I learned that it's not my fault that I worry, and I learned that actually there's a way I can self-soothe. So by the end of 6 weeks, it's really about not only getting in touch with your own self-compassion, which is so moving by the sixth week. Like, I am genuinely so grateful for the patients that share with us, and we get so much from it. But to see someone's transformation nearly, you know, to go from I worried to now, while this is so difficult and I have to live with this diagnosis, it doesn't take up my whole life, and to get that feedback is amazing.
And is that how you measure? You kind of, do you do a baseline kind of questionnaire at the beginning? Is that what it is?
So Clodagh does various different questionnaires. Like, one of them is the distress thermometer. I know you're familiar with that, but again, it's just about measure in the beginning, measure at the end, but then we also measure a good 12 weeks down the line as well. So like, have people been able to kind of take that on board, and then obviously compare it to a control arm of people who haven't been doing it, but we still offer it to them actually afterwards. So we're always rolling out.
And if somebody, say, completed the Comfort Trial, their 6 week course, would they still be allowed to access psycho-oncology services at another
point? Yeah, it's separate and simultaneous nearly. Like, sometimes we'll get, you know, the individual referral. You know, sometimes we'll actually, you know, Clodagh or myself will get, you know, the consultants or the teams contacting us directly, you know, patients contacting us directly, because they'll see the posters. And in a way, it's funny because you're kind of wondering at the end, you don't want them to be, you know, distressed and contacting psycho-oncology separately. But in a way, we're also seeing that people have never had maybe a reflective space, or never have gained the insight around themselves. And now they're saying, actually, I'd really like to talk about my diagnosis. I really like to talk about meaning in my life now, or acceptance around death. So while, of course, we in psycho-oncology need a certain sort of level of distress to access the service, there's also something really interesting in someone deciding, now is the time when I really want to access the service too.
That's great. And I suppose you said there how grateful you are for everybody that goes on the course, but I've no doubt they're very grateful for yourself and all the work that you're doing on their behalf as well. It's nice from us as nurses sometimes, if you see somebody in distress, just to have somewhere to advise them to go, or to be able to email somebody like Clodagh, because as you said, we can't be everything for everyone, but knowing that there's a service there, it's just
really changed.
It's so beneficial. And then maybe we might just talk about what the difference is between pity and self-compassion. question, if that's okay.
So it's a part of the course that I tried to actually look into, but it comes more from my memory of maybe sitting with the first patient I ever sat in St. Vincent's, where I think we spoke about compassion and she just said, "So you want me to pity myself?" And that always stuck with me. And I think I hear it a lot anyway. I do hear people sort of say, yeah, but does that not mean then I'm just going to kind of lay down and give up? And I suppose what we tried to educate people in the course is the sort of traits of compassion, which would take courage, which would take responsibility. There's a wisdom. And of course, then there's a self-kindness. But I suppose if you were to just think of it on a spectrum, you know, we often think of that idea of walking in someone's shoes. Pity has a sort of a looking down on someone. There isn't much feeling or thought. You just, you know, it is a looking down. And I think that's what makes us feel uncomfortable when we think, oh, I don't want anyone pitying me. And we kind of get defensive around it and we kind of want to push people away. And then I suppose you might have like sympathy, which is I extend it, I feel for you, and I have maybe thought about it. And empathy again is that one step further of like maybe being in, nearly being in someone's shoes, or that piece that we talked about earlier where we can really understand. We'll never know someone's perspective because it will always be theirs, but we can try to understand. And I guess compassion then is that like final step of, you know, I see you, I hear you, I feel it myself, and now I really want to try and ease your suffering. So it's that next step of I want to be there for you and help ease that suffering. It's not necessarily fix it, because we can't, but it's taking it to that next level. And so when someone talks about it for themselves, you know, I'll often joke about, yeah, so sometimes it's nice to treat yourself and have, you know, the cake and or buy yourself something, but it's really how you think towards yourself. If you have a very self-critical attitude where you're just like, come on, get on with it, you know, you have to just get on with it, there's no point in crying about this, that's quite harsh. It's like you're kicking yourself when you're down, versus the courage it takes to look at your suffering. And I guess we don't want to see our pain, do we? We want to kind of move away from it. But when you can have the courage to sit with your pain and know that you actually don't have to do anything with it, you're just acknowledging it. Oh, there you are. You're here. And then, like, you know, it goes. I often say what we resist persists.
So just touching off what you're saying there about self-compassion. So, like, it sounds like, and I know from my own personal experience, it's really difficult to be able to give yourself some self-compassion. So would you say like it should be classed as like a skill that people just need to learn how to do? So would you say it just takes practice? And
yes, absolutely. Okay. Practice, like we talk about kind of cultivating or growing self-compassion, but that's another part of the psychoeducation that we try to give, that actually for a lot of us, we, not that, you know, due to trauma in our past or harsh upbringings, but maybe we have learned a way of being, and it's not about blaming anybody, but it's maybe like, yeah, I actually had a really self-critical parent or teacher or someone who drove me with these high standards, but that voice sounded a little bit more critical than one of self-kindness. And it's like we put them on two ends of a spectrum, and we don't think that actually self-compassion can also be motivational and a drive, and it doesn't mean that you become lazy. But if you think about it, I suppose we try to describe the self-compassion or the compassion theory as like, you know, when you're in a threat mode. So if you think about, you know, back to our fight or flight, and you're in threat mode, you're very anxious, and it can feel like a threat then to be self-compassionate to yourself, because it can feel like, oh, well, if I am, then my defenses will be down.
Yeah.
Whereas I always try to say, you know, look at how would you soothe a small child or a baby or someone that you loved? It probably would be with kind words and less of the like, get on with it. And sometimes we'll joke in the group about maybe that Irish narrative as well, of like, you know, get on with it. But really, how can you say that in a more compassionate way? And like, think about how you're then building on this part of the brain rather than, say, the anxious part of the brain. Yeah. And, you know, neuropsychologists or neuroscientists would be like, stop minimizing or stop, you know, making the brain sound so basic. But actually, if you were to just work on, okay, I'm going to, you know, grow that part of the brain that's more soothing. So how do you do that first? I suppose you have to take down the distress. And that's why the breathing comes in, because if you can start with the breath work of, you know, really letting the body tell the mind, okay, I'm safe right now, and just watch that monkey mind of judgment and worry jump around, try to find distractions, and actually just say, okay, there's the monkey mind again, you know, I'm programmed to be that way, I'll just give him a distraction, the distraction is the breath, come back to the breath in and out. And then once you're kind of soothed, that's when you can kind of say, okay, this is difficult right now, or I'm doing my best. Again, it's not about trying to find the solution or find the answer. It's just acknowledging, okay, these are my emotions. You know, one of the tasks that we do, and people often refer back to it, but it's like, I'm just going to surf this emotion. I don't have to do anything with it. And I'm surfing it by just breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. And all of a sudden the emotion will just sort of dissolve a little. But the more we fight something, the more it sticks with us.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's going to be, that's the power of group work as well, isn't it? Because you kind of can kind of, with support, acknowledge all these things and learn a little bit about your thought processes.
And I always say to people as well, like, that it's not, say, a process group of everyone sharing each week, because that can really put people off. But what's really beautiful in session six is that we do a kind of a letter writing, and people can choose to share it or not. And sometimes the letter can just be, you know, how they found the 6 weeks. But mostly it is a, like, you know, dear me, I see what you've been through. And they have been the most, you know, tear jerkers, all right, but they have been the most transformative for everyone else in the group. You know, if you get a very poetic person nearly, they're like, oh, you said the words that I was feeling, and you can really feel everyone kind of come together.
Yeah, you see yourself in somebody else, which is, can take away that loneliness like you were talking about.
Completely. Yeah. And even though it's online, it you know, And we often say, like, it would be lovely if we all got together as a group. I think it doesn't lose the power of that connection.
That's brilliant. And you might share some more of the tips with us later. But speaking about mental health in general, how can people differentiate between what is normal and when should they be seeking help?
And, like, it's a really good question, because, like, how do you kind of standardize normal? And yes, we can, within, you know, psycho-oncology, have different psychometrics or different, you know, questionnaires. But ultimately, I just sort of say, is a person stuck? You know, do they feel that cancer is their every waking thought? Do they feel like they have no other joy in their life? Do they feel like they never have the motivation? You know, and there's, naturally, if you're looking for any sort of, you know, mental health issue like depression or anxiety, you might be looking for a criteria like you're staying in bed all the time, or you're not eating, you've no appetite, you're not sleeping, you're not socializing. But sometimes, and this is really important to remember in the world of cancer, is that we can't, you know, pathologize some of the symptoms that come with treatment. So someone could easily say in 1 week, well, I haven't seen anyone this week, I haven't got out in bed, I've no appetite, I feel sick, I'm vomiting, I don't really feel like socializing, I'm definitely low. But then that's where we often hear the phrase, like, okay, well, my good week this week, you know, you know that phrase, and people start to learn how their chemo treatment is, or the side effects. So really, it's more about, are you stuck? Do you find that you're so very distressed or upset that it's never leaving your mind, that the worry is taking up everything, that you feel like you're not getting that joy or that break, or feeling like, you know, it's becoming so overwhelming that you're not only feeling the physical symptoms of, again, maybe anxiety, but rather that you just feel like you can't get past it. And that even if you were sharing it with a friend or a family member, that that's not kind of resolving it. Because you'll often find, as you know yourself, that, like, if someone comes in and they have a chat on the day ward, that can be enough. You know, everyone, no matter where we are in life, we just want to be heard. And sometimes just having that space to do that. And especially, and I don't know if this is true to say more of women, but maybe, you know, we think about our children, or we worry about our family, and so we don't want to burden them. Now, of course, I hear that from men as well. But, you know, how much are you holding in? Is there any kind of escape for you that you can let some of that out? And again, there's, as I said, like, different, we try to meet someone where they're at. And that's what I was saying earlier about the different members of the team, from psychiatry, medical social work, psychology, you know, a clinical nurse specialist. And so maybe it's someone meeting in the day ward and saying, yeah, I just got to offload and it really helped, and you helped me kind of reframe how I'm thinking about some of my worry. You know, then there could be, you know, again, maybe a more existential piece. I really need to come to terms with my death, and I want to talk about that, and I need to talk, you know, in psychology or and again maybe even psychiatric, previous mental health, you know, whether it's that there's medication or, you know, that a person feels they need, you know, medication or a psychotropic, and or there's any sort of self-harm or any risk or anything where, you know, all hope, I think, is lost for that person. And then, of course, there's the community support. So it isn't always just psycho-oncology within any of the given hospitals, but there's, you know, ARC or like that. It might just be once off. But, like, not to underestimate anyone on the ground that's, like, the nurses in oncology and hematology. Like, they can be, or even the HSCPs. I remember recently I was... you know, working with an inpatient, but really I felt his real therapist was Dave. He used to bring him down for a coffee in Starbucks, you know? And I was like, I think that's your psychologist. So I think it's just as long as someone doesn't feel, and as long as someone doesn't feel so stuck, you know, and that can go for anything in life, you know, whether it was grief or illness or relationship breakdown, like that they feel they can on days move past it.
And you touched off there, which we know a lot of loved ones listen to, like a loved one of somebody going through a cancer diagnosis, listen to the podcast. And if there is somebody that is, I suppose, trying to support somebody that has is a bit distressed or is struggling with their emotions or their mental health, is there any, I suppose, tips or suggestions that you would have for how they could do that in that situation?
Like, I think even, you know, for us, we have to remember, you know, okay, you can't pour from an empty cup. And often I think, and again, probably relating back to my own experience, we're trying to juggle so much in terms of being there for the person who has cancer, or we might be trying to juggle getting into hospital appointments while balancing a job or looking after the home or children while also trying to be there for the person who is maybe an inpatient at that time. And how are we taking care of ourselves? Like, so is there other support, again, like whether it was through ARC or again, like our medical social worker, when we have, you know, families that really require that extra help, like saying it's okay that maybe I also need to see how much I can be there for someone. And I am a fan of journaling anyway, but maybe getting pen to paper and saying, okay, well, what are my worries? Or what are my fears? Or what is the worst of this for me? Because then maybe together with the person who has the diagnosis, they can sit and kind of say, so actually this is what I'm feeling. And maybe I'm thinking that you're feeling all these things and you're not. And it would really help for us to share this together and nearly kind of get a sheet of paper and have your list of what can be controlled and what can't be controlled. Okay, we can't control cancer, but we can control how we respond to it. So, you know, I can't control chemo days, but maybe I can actually control how I experience, you know, the day ward. I can't control what my consultant's going to say at the next appointment, but I can control how I am between now and then. Am I going to do breathing exercises? Am I going to do self-compassion exercises? You know, are we going to get walks in? Are we going to have things to look forward to? And I think sometimes at the end of the day, we are creatures who just like control. And when we have a diagnosis, all control feels like it's lost. And so working together as a team, and so not only acknowledging what you were feeling, but then also checking out with your partner, what is it that you're feeling, so that we can either be on the same page, or I can know that actually these are my feelings and they're not yours. And
that's really useful.
And does it need do I need a separate space to talk about those? Because I think for me, you know, personally, and I suppose this is kind of sharing a bit, but you know, I remember my mom saying, you know, I'm the one fighting cancer and you're all fighting each other, and I have four older brothers. And we were like, you know, who's going in, who's doing this, who's doing that? And I remember it just gave me so much pause. And even though I'm very much against the fighting cancer terminology, I knew what she was saying. She wanted us all to just, you know, be there for each other. And, you know, I guess she's the patient and she needed to say that to us, you know, because we were all struggling in our own stuff. So
Of course.
I think naturally as well, sometimes you can take it out on the people that you love and the people that you know you can. And I know that's not right, but I think it's a default. It's something sometimes we're all a little bit guilty of.
And I always like, I don't know, I just like kind of you know, metaphors or analogies or images, mm-hmm. but, you know, even a patient the other day was saying, I'm just getting so frustrated. And I'm like, you're telling me you haven't slept in I don't know how many weeks. Yeah. Of course you're getting frustrated.
Yeah.
So it's really about validating, mm-hmm. you know, and it's about listening to the person and not trying to fix it. So not trying to get to the next thing,
yeah.
but really listening to what they're saying,
mm-hmm.
and kind of validating, like, of course you'd feel frustrated.
Exactly.
But also in any situation, like if you think about a weighing scales, and our stress is always when we feel that we can't cope. So if the stress outweighs our coping skills, mm-hmm. and then when we feel confident and we can cope and our coping outweighs the stress, then we don't feel mm-hmm. overwhelmed and agitated. So it's always just about trying to see what that balance is, and yes. you know, mm-hmm. yeah, just I guess trying to find it, which is difficult.
Yeah, which could be the hard part.
yeah,
exactly. And I suppose for people who are listening, is there any practical tips that people could be doing themselves at home to support their emotional and mental well-being? I know we touched a little bit on the breathing side of things. Is there other things that people might do to support themselves at home?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm always just right into the breath. Take a breath. Yes. It's like, you know, the nose is for breathing, the mouth is for eating, and it's always like nose yeah. in, low and slow. And I think, you know, maybe wrongly or rightly, but I think mindfulness became a bit of a buzzword, and people started to say, oh God, I can't stand that, or and it's difficult. So try to strip past things like, oh, I need to meditate, or I need to do this, and get rid of the shoulds, and just actually sit quiet, sit with yourself, sit with your breath, and see the impact of actually just inhaling in and out, because that's your natural, you know, soothing rhythm. It, mm-hmm. it just happens for you automatically. And I think just, again, I said about the power of journaling, but maybe just, you know, getting pen to paper and saying, okay, what is happening for me right now? Because I think that will lead you in the direction then of saying, actually, maybe I need to talk to a professional mm-hmm. in order to be able to help myself in this situation mm-hmm. so that I amn't, you know, absolutely exhausted and not there for the people who I want to be there for.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So again, yeah, I think, and like really take into account sleep, diet, exercise.
Yeah.
But it's like going back to the basics. And sometimes even around self-compassion, I'll say, okay, if you think about a small little baby and they'll cry when they're fed or when they're not fed and when they're tired and, you know, when they need a change. And actually we need to do that for ourselves. So like, what's my sleep hygiene like? Do I set up my room in the best possible way? Do I mind myself? Do I know how to mind myself? And really get back to those basics of, and then if not, and it's like, right, I need to go straight to my GP and have a chat and maybe see what I need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brilliant. That's great. Because as you said, they are the basics, but sometimes the mm-hmm. basics are the hardest thing to grasp, because you know what to do, but it can be so difficult mm-hmm. to do it at times. Mm-hmm. But it's good to know that those options are there, and mm-hmm. that and people do actually know what to do and they have the skills. It's just sometimes retraining yourself to do them again. And then would you mind just telling us about compassion-focused approach that is often needed with cancer patients? And maybe you might be able to do a little bit of an exercise with us, like we talked about earlier on.
So I suppose, you know, from a psychology point of view, there's, you know, many different theoretical orientations, whether it's CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, acceptance and commitment therapy. You know, these are all theories that, of course, you know, we learn and we have to try and, you know, implement, and we're the ones that learn them and then we try to share them sort of therapeutically. And I suppose with compassion focused theory, it is that idea of just trying to build on that self-soothing and try to reduce that distress that we might be naturally prone to. And then how can we change that inner critical voice that we actually all have? It's not like, you know, we're all going around, you know, so harsh to everybody else as well, but that we do, we can just be a little bit harder on ourselves. So how do I notice, oh yeah, there I go again saying, well, you should have done that or you shouldn't have done that. And how can I change that to a more compassionate voice? Mm. So yeah, we could do just a really short exercise, which is one of the things that we do in the group. So I always just say, yeah, try to find a relaxing position, maybe your 2 feet on the ground. And again, that's just to kind of ground yourself or to signal your spine to your mind that actually I'm present, and you know, it's not about falling asleep and having a lovely nap, as I think people often perceive it to be. And if you want to close your eyes, it just kind of helps you to have a focus. And then all we want to do is focus on our breath. So again, it's such a simple activity, it happens naturally. But our minds are programmed to be busy and to be always looking for distractions, whether it's in sounds or sensations, or sometimes our mind will be taken to worries. So when we say just to bring that focus to the breath, we're just concentrating as if you were almost responsible for breathing in and out. It happens unconsciously, but if you had to consciously be aware of breathing in and breathing out. And again, whatever is natural for you, but if you can breathe in through the nose and out through the mouth, or even better, in through the nose and out through the nose. But again, it's more about just finding a natural rhythm for you. So breathing in and out. Breathing in and out. In and out. And perhaps noticing if you can get that breath, not in such a big breath that you're going to take a gaspy inhale, but rather you're getting it low, as in low down into the diaphragm. So you're almost feeling your tummy just under your rib cage lift. And if it helps, you can maybe rest your hand on that tummy or just under the rib cage to notice on your next inhale, is there a rise, and on the exhale, a fall. So breathing in and breathing out. So deepening that breath just with the length that you inhale and with the length of your exhale out. So again, breathing in, feeling the rise, and then on your exhale out, feeling the fall. So if you were to do that even for a minute a day, that would be a mindful exercise, or it would be just a present moment exercise. And just even now, you might notice that actually, yes, there's a calming effect. And that is your body signaling to the mind, okay, I can be at rest. So if you want to just let your hand rest again on your lap, and I'm going to ask you to just bring a slight smile to your face. So you're not showing your teeth, but you're just curving up the edges of your mouth in a slight smile. And you're going to breathe in now and breathe out again, just keeping that slight smile on your mouth, and maybe keeping your mouth closed or opening it, obviously, if you need to breathe out. But just breathing in again with that slight smile, breathing in, breathing out. And maybe noticing if there's a contentment that smile brings. So again, we know from psychological studies that the facial muscles in a smile can signal a state of joy. But right now we're just bringing a state of contentment where we're breathing in and breathing out. And again, I suppose just for the sake of this exercise, I'm just going to ask you to call to mind someone who you love, who you know loves you, and that almost when you think of them, that slight smile becomes natural. And sometimes we can call to mind someone who loved us, who's this deceased or not with us anymore. And while there might be sadness in that, we don't want to get caught up in that right now. We just want to nearly bring about the felt sense of what it's like when we imagine this person who really loves us, or maybe this person that we really love. And again, we just want to maybe call to mind a phrase that they use for us when we're in difficulty. And it could be your pet name. It could be an abbreviation of your name or a nickname. It could be that they just say, it's okay, pet, don't worry, darling. Or as I said, it could be, I'm here for you, boo, or whatever your name is. And again, just breathing in and out, just that sense of that reassurance. That kind of calming phrase, or that sense of someone really being there for you. And all we want to do is breathe in and out to that sense of someone being there for us, and really letting that feeling sit with us, so that we're nearly feeling the sensation of love, of kindness. And then when you're ready, you can kind of let the natural smile go from your face. But I want you to keep in mind that sensation and that sentiment of, I'm here for you, or you're doing your best. Or again, that nickname that might be used in times of difficulty. And take that away today as maybe the internal voice that you use with yourself now instead. So that instead of maybe being critical or giving out to yourself, that you use that same phrase or that same nickname. And that's building on being compassionate for yourself. So we'll just take in a last breath and maybe visualizing bringing in that loving sentiment and then exhaling out that loving sentiment and kindness as if to others. So breathing in and exhaling out. And again, in and out. And last one, in and out. And then when you're ready, maybe just opening your eyes and giving yourself a little stretch. And even if you feel, oh, that was a bit trickier than I thought, or actually lots came up for me, or I wasn't quite sure, it's just, I suppose, the start of, okay, this is how I can start to treat myself differently.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Nate. This has been such a privilege. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Answers for Cancers podcast. Please share this podcast with anybody who you think it might help. Also, if you can like and subscribe, it lets people know we're here. You can alternatively contact us on Instagram at @theanswersforcancers_podcast. And if you have any questions on anything that we discussed today, please email us at theanswersforcancerspodcast@gmail.com, or you can DM us on Instagram.